So the idea today was to have this introduction of the theory in general, and then to tell you something about what the theory, how it is used in practice now, in practice means in astrophysics. And when I was a graduate student, general relativity was very much a thing done in maths departments, and it was all theory. And over the course of my career, it has become a major tool of in interpreting data and information. It's very much in daily use in understanding the real universe. And there are many aspects to this, and Pedro and I are just going to talk about two of these aspects. There are many other things that we could talk about, and one of the things that we're not going to talk about that will be, I think, in the newspapers in the next couple of years is gravitational waves, because they're going to be detected in the next couple of years and open up a new window on the universe. But I'm going to talk about what's now a very well-established part of astronomy, and that's gravitational lensing. So here is my kind of my outline, talk about the deflection of light in principle, the general physical ideas, the general formalism that emerges from general relativity for the gravitational deflection of light, then talk about deflection by galaxies and clusters of galaxies, which are extended sources of mass distributions, and then talk about deflection of light by stars, which are more or less point masses, where things work out a little bit differently, and then I'll talk about the situation more or less one century after Eddington electrified the world by confirming Einstein's prediction for deflection of light by the sun. So the deflection of light by a gravitational field is a very straightforward consequence of the general theory of relativity, the principle of equivalence. The way to think about this is that if you were in a cruising capsule in space, like the International Space Station or whatever, everybody knows that there's no gravitational field in there. There seems to be no gravitational field in there. Everything falls freely together because of the principle of equivalence. So if you release a droplet of water or whatever in the middle of the capsule, it just stays in the middle of the capsule. The space station is in the Earth's gravitational field and in the sun's gravitational field. There's masses of gravity all over the place, but the capsule and the water droplet all fall together. In this frame of reference of the capsule, there appears to be no gravitational field. That is the principle of equivalence. So now imagine that you are you're conducting a series of experiments in which space capsules are being blasted past a point mass or a compact object like a neutron star or a black hole faster and faster and faster. So you're doing some kind of hyperbolic orbit past this object faster and faster and faster. Until you more or less get to the speed of light. Then by the special relativistic principle that moving clocks go slowly, the time on your watch in the capsule that it takes for the neutron star to appear in your windscreen up front and whoosh up behind you and disappear into the back will get shorter and shorter and shorter. From the perspective of special relativity, you can say, oh, you know, my clock's perfectly all right. It's telling the correct time. What's happening is that there's a Lorentz contraction of the distance between me and the neutron star, so it's really only a couple of centimeters away. No, so naturally, it whizzes by very quickly. From the perspective of the person on the neutron star, he says that it really took ages to pass the neutron star, but these people in the capsule, their clocks run slowly. Anyway, when you're in the capsule, you feel no gravitational field because you're freely falling, and you go into the gravitational field, we would say, into the gravitational field of the neutron star very quickly and come back out of it very quickly. So if there's a photon, if you flash a little bit of light from the middle of the in the capsule, it won't move very far through the capsule in the time on your clock, because the photon, of course, is operating on your time. Your clock is telling you that photon is moving at the speed of light. So if it doesn't have very much time, it can't go very far. So it doesn't go very far in the time it takes for the neutron star to whip underneath you. So this photon, as you go faster and faster and faster, the time available for the time required to whiz past the neutron star gets less and less and less. The photon moves a smaller and smaller distance, and so it basically follows the same trajectory as the capsule, and the limit of the capsule goes at the speed of light. So if you want to know, by the principle of equivalence, if you want to know how a photon moves in a gravitational field, all you need to do is figure out how does an object like a bullet or a capsule, a material object, move in the limit as you go at the speed of light. So this was Einstein's thought pattern before 1915. And here is here's the calculation, which is very much the kind of thing you might ask an entrance interview, ask the students to sort this one out. The general idea is that you are whizzing past this line at the top so fast that that's strictly speaking a hyperbola around this point mass down here, but it's you're going so fast the hyperbola is very little bent, so we can just approximate it with a straight line, and we can assume that we go more or less at a constant speed along this hyperbola v. That's an approximation, but it's fine. And then we compute the perpendicular force. Here's this gm over r squared operates down this line here. We compute the component that's perpendicular to the trajectory. So that's just taking the cosine of this angle, which is b over r times it. And then we just have to integrate this perpendicular force over the time that it takes from minus infinity to plus infinity to pass by. And that will give us the force times time equals momentum. So that will give us the amount of mass times component of velocity perpendicular to this line. This will tell you how much velocity you pick up perpendicular to your original trajectory in an approximate way. And then the deflection angle, because the amount by which you're deflected is going to be given by the angle is going to be the perpendicular component of velocity over the parallel component of velocity. So that's this formula here. V perpendicular over your speed will become this, because this integral is just the number one. It turns out it's easy to show. Again, that's a suitable exercise for an entrance candidate. And so you end up with the deflection angle this combination of Newton's constant, the mass of your body and the speed of light, is what's called the Schwarzschild radius. And so it's just a quantity with the dimensions of length you can make out of these things. So this you can arrange as the Schwarzschild radius divided by your impact parameter. That's this distance between your closest approach, if you did move on a straight line, times c squared over v squared, but we're interested in the limit as v goes to c, so c squared over v squared goes to 1. So your deflection angle, beautiful simple result, is the Schwarzschild radius divided by your impact parameter. And if you ask, okay, so what's the implication for this for the sun? The closest to the sun that you can fire a photon, or some star in the remote cosmos can fire a photon at us and it reaches, is one that just grazes the surface of the sun. Anything that goes closer to the middle of the sun than the surface of the sun is going to, of course, be absorbed by the sun. So we better put in for B, our most optimistic, get the biggest angle. We put in for B the smallest thing that's reasonable, which is the radius of the sun, which is about 700,000 kilometers. And since this RS for the sun is about 3 kilometers, you end up with an angle of 0.875 arc second, so a bit less than an arc second. That's the biggest deflection that you can get by passing light by the surface of the sun by this reckoning. So in 1919, Eddington, the First World War being finally out of the way, Eddington and colleagues measured this deflection by looking by comparing a star field photographed during a total eclipse of the sun with the same star field photographed 6 months earlier or whatever, when the sun was quite out of the way, not in that part of the sky, and found a deflection which was consistent with being exactly twice the number we've just got. The general relativistic prediction, the prediction that Einstein arrived at in 1915 when he had a proper theory, was that the deflection is twice the naive value that we just obtained there by that sort of more or less Newtonian calculation. Why is that? That is because gravity is actually a velocity-dependent force in the same way that electromagnetism is. So here are the equations of motion of a particle of charge Q and rest mass M0 moving in electromagnetic fields E and B, which are neatly arranged in a 4x4 matrix F mu nu. And John talked about how in relativity you use elegant notations that make complicated things look simple. And this is an example. So this is the equation of motion electromagnetism, and here is the four velocity of a particle. And we people who move slowly have four velocities which are more or less consist of our time component, because we're all racing at the speed of light into the future and moving rather slowly from point to point. And the time component of that vector into this matrix is the electrostatic force, and the spatial parts of this vector, the velocity, the actual deposition by the proper time, is the Lorentz force that multiplies into the magnetic field buried inside here and makes the Lorentz force, and that's magnetism, which makes our civilization run, right? You know, electric motors, the dynamos that make the lights, everything, it's all magnetic, it's all relativistic corrections, right? Our civilization runs on a relativistic correction, a relativistic effect that we call magnetism. Well, here is the equation of motion, John showed us this, that comes from a geodesic, it's rearranged. Here we have the rest mass, here we have the rest mass, so it cancels, that's the principle of equivalence. Instead of having F, we have the Christoffel symbol, which has two hooks at the bottom, not just one hook at the bottom, and to soak them up, we need two copies of the four velocity. And we, in Newtonian gravity, we're familiar with the part of this horrendous sum that comes from the time component of this and the time component of that, because the Earth is very slow moving relative to the Sun, etc. I'm very slow moving with respect to the Earth, so we can neglect the four velocity components apart from the time component. But if you're a photon, your four velocity has a space component which is as big as its time component. That's the key thing about photons moving at the limiting speed, is their space components are equal to their time components. Well, all of space components taken together have the same weight as the time component. So there's a really important contribution to this gravitational force coming from the velocity of the photon. And by Murphy's law, you might have imagined that velocity-dependent part of the force on a photon would cancel the force, the electrostatic part, as it were, the Newtonian gravitational part, but where Murphy's law was suspended, and it worked actually to add up so that you get twice the deflection. Okay, so the thing is now that... the point I wanted to make on this one is that when do you need to use general relativity rather than Newtonian gravity? Either when you're dealing with a strong gravitational field, like around a black hole or something, or even in a weak gravitational field, if you're dealing with fast-moving objects. Photons are fast-moving objects, and we know about the universe overwhelmingly because of photons. We have a very little bit of information coming from neutrinos. We have, and cosmic ray particles, we're hoping to have some information coming from gravitational waves, but really we depend on photons, and the universe is full of weak gravitational fields. So general relativity is really, really, really important from that, because of those facts. So Einstein's field equations are valid in arbitrary coordinate systems. In fact, one, I think the most effective way of arriving at the Einstein equations is by saying, okay, I'm just going to figure out what the equations of ordinary boring physics like electromagnetism would look like if I allowed any old coordinate system to be used. And then these things like the Christoffel symbols would appear, and we'd be on our way. So we have complete freedom when doing general relativity in what coordinates we use. When you do Newtonian dynamics at high school, you don't have complete freedom at all. You have to use inertial coordinates or the equations of motion. X double dot is mx double dot is force. Doesn't work. But as Lenin said, liberty is precious, so precious that it must be rationed. And judicious choice of coordinate system is at the core of theoretical physics. That if you use the right coordinate system, the computation becomes possible, which if you're not using the right coordinate system, you'll die of overwork and not achieve it. So all coordinate systems may be equal, but some coordinate systems are a hell of a lot more equal than others. And this is very, very, very much true in general relativity. John mentioned that in the last decade or so, there's been real progress in the numerical solution of Einstein's equations, and in very large measure that derives from proper attention to this principle that the computer also has to be told, has to be guided in what coordinate system to use. Now, the most equal coordinates are, and the ones that overwhelmingly you should use, and you should always use if you're dealing with a weak gravitational field, are these things called harmonic coordinates. So high school mechanics, as I've said, is based on inertial Cartesian coordinates. And harmonic coordinates, say Clausewitz said that war is the continuation of diplomacy by other means, and harmonic coordinates are the continuation of Cartesian coordinates, inertial coordinates, in difficult circumstances. The thing is, once masses have started crumpling up space and time, you can't have Cartesian inertial coordinates simply don't exist. You can set up a Cartesian system, but it won't be inertial. Or you can set up an inertial system, and it won't be Cartesian. These harmonic coordinates are sort of the best choice. The condition for the technique, for those who like equations, that defines inertial coordinates is this. You put the metric tensor, you contract it into the Christoffel symbol, you insist that's zero, that's a first order differential equation on the metric, and you insist on that being satisfied, and that defines harmonic coordinates. And it's really just a gauge condition analogous to in electromagnetism. You might choose to use the Coulomb gauge, which says the divergence of the... But that's beside the point. Right. So what in harmonic coordinates, what does a weak gravitational field look like? Well, the metric tensor can be this Minkowski tensor plus h mu nu, and h is just the next letter after g. It's nothing to do with Planck's constant. It's just the next letter after g. So that's why people use it. And what can we say about... here's the Minkowski metric. We've already seen that. And what can we say about h? Well, the amazing thing is we can say about h is that it consists of two... It really only has four non-zero components. It has a time-time component, which is given by this, where that's Newton's gravitational potential, the thing we're all familiar with. Well, I hope we're all familiar with. And here, we in the space-space, this Roman means space-space, so there's HXX, HYY, and HZZ, is given by this, which is almost the same as that, except, oh hell, I've forgotten to change that to a minus sign. That's meant to be a minus sign. I don't know how that happened. Right, so this one has a minus sign here, and he has a minus sign there. Just imagine it. And here we have it right. So the metric is taking this unbelievably simple form, and it's related now to something that we all know about, Newton's gravitational potential. Okay, now photons, of course, choose paths on which the invariant distance is zero. So we want ds squared to be zero, which means that that this thing gets multiplied by dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared, and that's got to cancel on this thing multiplied by c squared dt squared. So if I take this ratio of coordinate distance gone in time, in coordinate time elapsed, I end up with because of this square rooting business, I have a square root. And I have this thing, I have this thing divided by this thing, I get that. If I binomially expand this, because Newton's constant has dimensions of velocity squared, and so here on the Earth, the value of Newton's constant is roughly 20 kilometers a second squared, the free fall speed from infinity to the Earth, and the speed of light is 300,000 kilometers a second, and we need to square it. So phi of a c squared is a jolly small number on the Earth. So we can surf, we can binomially expand this, and we end up with that expression there. So this now I can interpret as the speed of a photon. The speed of the photon, coordinate distance gone over coordinate times elapsed, is equal to this quantity, this thing here, the velocity of light divided by this thing here. So in other words, this speed is less than the speed of light. Why less? Because phi is negative. Phi, we're in a potential well, so we have negative potential energy. So phi is negative, and therefore this thing on the bottom is bigger than one. Now in a piece of glass, we say that the speed of photons is the speed of light divided by the refractive index, which is greater than one. So we say photons travel slower than the speed of light. This is of course not true. Photons in glass travel at the same speed of light, but they take regular rests on the silica atoms or whatever. They rest from time to time, and that makes them seem to go slowly. So it is here, our photons are really traveling at the speed of light, but there's more in a potential well, because of this curvature of space and time, there is more space than our harmonic coordinates allow. So this is an underestimate of the distance that they've gone. But forget that, that's not the way to think about it. The way to think about it is that there is this perfect, there is this ordinary boring flat space, defined for which the Minkowski metric is the metric, and space has acquired a refractive index. And so photons are traveling at different speeds in different places, and it's just like propagating through the atmosphere on a hot day in the Sahara or whatever, where you're going to get mirages and stuff. So how do you calculate how light moves through an optical system, how light would propagate during on a hot day when there are mirages and whatnot? Well, you'll use Fermat's principle of least time, which is brought to us by quantum mechanics, that along the paths for which this integral, the time it takes the photon to travel, so that's distance divided by velocity, c over the refractive index, this time of flight has to be stationary, so neighboring paths have the same time of flight. Because if they don't have the same time of flight, then virtual photons that travel on adjacent trajectories will arrive with shifted phases, and they will destructively interfere with each other. And we will consider that the photons have really only traveled along paths in which neighboring paths constructively interfere, because they arrive with the same phase. So that's why Fermat's principle is there. And if you just ask, so what are the paths which have stationary phases for transit, spatially transit, sorry, arrival times, it's a problem in the calculus of variations, and a fairly straightforward calculation leads to this conclusion, that the difference between this angle here, so dx by ds of the observer is actually this angle here, minus dx by ds over here. Now this angle is, this dx by ds is here negative, dx by ds here is positive. So when you subtract these two, you're really taking the sum of this angle and this angle, which by some geometry is obviously this angle here, alpha. So this here is actually minus alpha if you worry about the signs. And that's this integral along the trajectory, along the path, the stationary path, of the perpendicular component of the gradient of the refractive index. So that's how you compute how the gravitational field associated with some masses in here causes this bending. It's just an exercise in optics. So that picture is just showing what's happening in the x direction, which is one of the two directions perpendicular to the general direction between observer and source, which we put to be the z direction. There's something similar happening in the y direction. Consequently, you end up with a formula like this that says the deflection angle on the sky, which is a two vector, the amount by which the source, because remember, we positions on the sky are just angles, so the amount by which the source is displaced, the image of the source is displaced from the actual position of the source, that's the vector alpha, two-dimensional vector on the sky, that this thing is simply minus the integral along the line of sight from source to observer of the two-dimensional gradient, the gradient of the refractive index induced by the gravitational field, in the directions perpendicular to the line of flight. And when you put in what, so what is n, the refractive index was 1 minus 2 phi over c squared. So the derivative, the gradient of 1 is nothing, obviously, so we have the gradient of phi twice over on c squared appearing in a minus sign. So we get 2 over c squared, that minus sign goes away, and we have this formula here. Now we can relate this deflection produced by the gravitational potential to the surface density of matter on the sky or in space between you and the source as follows. We know that the Newton's gravitational potential is related to the density of matter by Poisson's equation here, that del squared phi, the divergence of the gradient of phi, the divergence of the gravitational force, is 4 pi g times the density of matter. So let's work out what the surface density of matter is between us, between source and observer. Well, it's the integral along the line of sight of the density. Replace this density by del squared phi over 4 pi g, right? Density is del squared phi over 4 pi g, and expand del squared phi into its part, into its derivatives perpendicular to the line of sight and its derivatives along the line of sight, and you end up with this expression here. And then this we can integrate. Everybody can integrate a gradient. Again, a question, suitable question for an entrance candidate. And when you do, you find that this is the difference in the gravitational force caused by the scattering center at the source and at us. Now, this scattering center will turn out to be a galaxy hundreds of millions or thousands of millions of light years away from us. And the gravitational force it's exerting on us or on the source is peanuts. So forget that. So this term is negligible. The integral of this term is negligible. And this the integral of this that matters, so we end up with this here. So we want to relate this to this. And again, it's suitable, well, it's that we're now on to an end of first year question, that you, in order to relate this to this, you need to take the divergence of this up here to get another one of these Nabler operators inside there. So that's what we do. We take the divergence of this angle, and that's equal, according to taking the divergence of this side, all we do is upgrade this to a Nabler squared, and then we have this. But lo, what's this? That's already appearing here, apart from some 4 pi g's. So we find that this divergence of the scattering angle is just 8 pi g of c squared times the surface density. So we have an amazing method now of determining what the projected density of matter is between us and the source just by measuring these scattering angles. Okay, so let's apply this. There are two archetypal situations in which we want to apply this. One is to galaxies, which are extended sources, and one is to point sources of mass. Let's think about the stars first. If we want to deal with a star, we put the surface density as the mass of the star times the Dirac delta function of r. That's the surface density associated with a star which is located at r equals naught on the sky, wherever that is. And in order to make sense of a Dirac delta function, you have to put it inside an integral, so stuff it in. What we will do is integrate both sides of our equation up here over the little piece of sky which includes the point source, the star. Here is the integral of the divergence. We can use the divergence theorem in order to represent that as 2 pi r, which is the circumference. This is a two-dimensional divergence. So the bounding surface is a circle. That's the magnitude of the circle, times the scattering angle, the scattering amount on that circle. And that should be equal to the integral of this with m put in there. And that just gives us this, which tells us that the scattering angle is 4 pi g over r c squared, which is twice the Schwarzschild radius divided by radius by impact parameter. So there we are, we're back. This is the general relativistic result with the crucial factor of 2 that wasn't present in our original naive calculation. When we play the game with galaxies, to model a galaxy, the way to go is to say, well, roughly speaking, these are objects which have extended mass distributions so that the circular speed, the speed at which you'd have to go to be in a circular orbit around them is pretty much independent of radius. So we make the straightforward model. We say the circular speed is a constant. Then it's a an entrance candidate question to show that in those circumstances the mass density has to fall off like 1 over r squared, and with the coefficient sort of vc squared, well anyway, the coefficients are a little harder, but to see that it goes like 1 over r squared should be relatively straightforward. And if you integrate this down the line of sight to find what the corresponding surface density is, it's also a fairly straightforward calculation to find that it's just this. It goes like 1 over r with this coefficient vc squared over 4g in front. So if you now put this surface density into here, the divergence on the left, in which is now going to be in cylindrical polar coordinates or plane polar coordinates, is going to look like this. That's a first year maths sort of exercise to do that. So you'll have this for the divergence of alpha, and on the right side you'll have some numbers times 1 over r. You can cancel the r's, so this right hand side becomes a constant. So you integrate up with r, you get an r over here, which then cancels with that one, and you find that alpha is a constant. It's just equal to this number over here. So galaxies deflect photons, roughly speaking, through a particular angle, characteristic angle, which is 2 pi times the square of the vc over the speed of light squared. Really simple result. Whereas stars deflect things by an amount which goes like 1 over r and gets really large when r is very small, although our calculation is not to be trusted. We're doing weak field gravity, so if r is anything near to rs, our calculation is not accurate. Lensing by galaxies, so how does that work out then? Okay, so here is a source, here is us, and here is the center of a galaxy or a cluster of galaxies, one of these extended mass distributions. And so one photon will be, of course, I've grossly exaggerated this direction. And you have to imagine this as really, really seriously spread out. And I've drawn these as straight lines. They're really curvy kind of things. But the key thing is that one photon is going to be bent round like that through this magic angle, 2 pi times vc over c squared. That's this angle up here. And another one's going to come down the backside. Another photon will just skim the backside of the center here and be bent through the same angle, because the bending angle is independent of radius. And this photon is going to miss us. So what happens here is that we see this source once. We see it down this line of sight, displaced from its true position by the bending angle. Now let's move the center of our deflecting mass or galaxy a little bit further in. When we get to this point here, suddenly this photon hits us and we see it. We see now the source twice, once down here and once up there. And if we move our galaxy further in and further in and further in, this red photon path remains a valid photon path, exactly the same path, and we will continue to see that source twice and separated by twice the bending angle. Okay, and when the source is exactly in the middle, so it's exactly on the line of sight, the geometrical line of sight from us to the source, what we're seeing here in this particular plane will work in every plane, and we won't just see two images, we'll see a ring of brightness. And here is an almost, this telephone number is telling us about the right ascension and declination of some radio source, some radio galaxy, which is how this thing has been found. Or this is an optical picture, and here is the deflecting galaxy, and here is a background active galactic nucleus, so a glowing black hole whose image has been spread out almost into one of these Einstein rings, because this galaxy sits almost exactly on the center line between us and the source. And what's the bending angle, the characteristic bending angle? Well, this diagram, which I think I better not take time to explain, but it is just elementary geometry. We say this is the angle at which we're seeing. This is the angle here at which we're seeing the source, because we see the source along here, though really it's straight there. So we wait the formula for this side of the thing from this triangle and this distance from this triangle, we equate these two, and what do we get? We find that this angle is
is the circular speed of the deflecting source, the galaxy, divided by 1,000 kilometers a second, which is some handy number, all squared times 7.2 arc seconds. So that's the numerology times, sorry, this ratio of distances in front, which will be on the order of one. So since galaxies have, well, clusters of galaxies have characteristic circular speeds of order 1,000 kilometers a second, big galaxies have characteristic circular speeds of maybe 300 kilometers a second, you can see that we can hope to see these imaging events with objects with their images separated by a few arc seconds. So the first lensed object had this telephone number up here, right ascension declination, and I still remember the excitement that this created at the Institute of Advanced Study in Princeton when this was discovered by Walsh et al. In 1979. This was the original kind of picture. No, this wasn't the original picture, actually. This comes from a follow-up paper by Young and company using then very new CCD technology. But anyway, these are two quasars. This is roughly speaking Walsh et al. Were working with. They had two quasars very close on the sky, as I say, separated by about six arc seconds, and they both had a redshift of 1.405. So to that many significant figures, the redshifts of these two objects were the same, and they tentatively concluded that this was one quasar which was being gravitationally lensed. And then Young and company, using the then very new CCD detectors, obtained this picture of the field, this proper image, and this is an unresolved point source here. This is a point source with a sky and the telescope optics scattering the image into some extended form, and this is another one here, but these contours here are more extended and they betray the existence of the scattering galaxy, and here is a scattering galaxy and so on. So this was in a cluster of galaxies. People then did systematic searches for these things, and some dozens of these objects have been found. And many of them, we've already looked at this one, many of them, quite a number of them, have four images, not two images, and not rings. And the reason for that is that the mass distributions that are doing the lensing are not circularly symmetric. So we've been using the approximation of spherically symmetric lenses. Once you get a bit real about this, you realize you have to make the lens distribution sort of ellipsoidal, and then you find that the two sources, the two images, often break up into four images, etc., etc., etc. Weak lensing is now really where it is. So if you're outside the Einstein radius, you see only one image, and you might think that's boring. But if you're not too far from the Einstein radius, where another image will appear, which will then spread as you move towards the center into the Einstein ring. If you're not too far from the Einstein radius, your images become really seriously distorted. So here and here and here and here, you see horribly distorted images of galaxies far, far, far behind this cluster of galaxies, which glories in the name of Abel 2218. You see images of background galaxies which have been horribly stretched, and they're horribly stretched perpendicular to the local gravitational field. So you're seeing, if you draw in little perpendiculars to the images, you're essentially seeing the direction of the gravitational field. And of course, by detailed quantitative work, especially if you can figure out from the color of these images, for example, how far in the background the distance is to those sources, you're actually able to measure the strength of the gravitational field at these points. So this is a very extreme example of what's called weak lensing, which is just the distortion of an image, not a making of multiple. Strong lensing is the making of more than one image of a source, but weak lensing is just the distortion. And there's a huge amount of effort going currently into the exercise of looking for the distortion of the images of hundreds of millions of galaxies. There's a very slight distortion of the images of hundreds of millions of galaxies, so that the gravitational field can be comprehensively mapped as a function of redshift, because how the gravitational field, the strength of the gravitational fields of galaxies and clusters of galaxies, especially clusters of galaxies and groups of galaxies, has grown over cosmic time is connected to the existence of dark energy, which we will be hearing a bit more of later, and is also connected to this horrible problem of the cosmological constant. So quickly, something about the, because I'm really, really, really short of time, deflection of light by stars. The thing is that if you do the same kind of analysis that I've did with the galaxies, we had the deflection angle went like 1 over radius, 1 over impact parameter. So that means, the consequence of that is that there are, in principle, always a point mass always produces two images. But unless you're close to the Einstein radius of the source, which is defined by this, so here's the Schwarzschild radius, 2gm over c squared, and here are distances, distance from the source to the lens, distance to the source, distance to the lens. Unless unless the true position of the source, it lies within something like theta e, one of these images will be so faint it probably won't be detectable. But in principle, there are always two. And the characteristic, if you put in some characteristic numbers for lensing, for characteristic numbers for stars, you'll find, so the Schwarzschild radius is about 3 kilometers for a solar mass object. And it's supposing we make these distances sort of like 10 kiloparsecs so that we're looking at stars within our own galaxy. You kind of need to do that. You need to confine this experiment within our own galaxy. Then you come to the conclusion that this angle is something like 0.7 milliarcseconds. So the scale of which this lensing happens by an individual star, the splitting of the images, is 1,000 times smaller than the scale associated with the splitting by large galaxies and clusters of galaxies. And this separation is too small even for the Hubble Space Telescope, even for the James Webb Space Telescope. It's too small for anybody to measure at this time and in the foreseeable future. But the great thing is that if you look towards the center of our galaxy, you can figure from this that on the order of one star in a million is suffering one of these lensing effects at any given time. And of course, there are hundreds of millions of stars visible towards the center of our galaxy, so there must be hundreds of stars being lensed at any given time. And you can detect this lensing because even though you can't separate the images, the brightness of the object is enhanced by one of these lensing events. And the brightness, this explains how you can compute, it rises and then it falls. This is the path that the brightness would take if the deflecting star passes within 0.1 Einstein radii of the source. So, and this is a magnification by a factor of 10. So large magnification factors are possible, and people have been for the last 15 years or so monitoring hundreds of millions of stars every night. And this was the very first lensing event to be detected. So this is just two, this is a blue band, this is a red band, this is kind of showing that the brightness of the star rises and falls in all bands simultaneously. And by studying the time scale associated with this event, you can figure out what the typical mass of the deflectors is. And the answer is that it's on the order of 0.8 of a solar mass. And you can also figure out that most of the mass in the center of our galaxy has indeed to be invested in stars, not in dark matter, not in insular matter, not in any hokey-pokey anything. It's in really boring, not in planets, it's in really boring stars. So that's been established by this technique. You can also detect planets by this technique. Here is a star which people figured out was going to from this part of the curve, they could figure out that the source was going to come very, very close behind. This deflecting thing was going to come very, very much in front of the star behind. So it was going to be a very powerful magnification. So here's the magnification by the star, and here's the magnification by its Jupiter-like planet. And quite a number of planets have been detected this way. It's a method by which you can detect Earth mass planets that live at the center of the galaxy and might have people shattering on them. And they get detected in this moment and they'll never be seen again. We will never have ever know anything else about them whatsoever. So I should finish. I just want to say, this is a peen to the march of technology, that Gaia, is this satellite here, is currently mapping the positions of a billion stars in our galaxy. And the precision with which it determines positions is 20 microarc seconds. And if you're 45 degrees from the sun, if a photon that passes within 45 degrees away from the sun is deflected by about 10 milliarc seconds, in other words, 1,000 times what Gaia can detect. The consequence of that is that the general relativistic distortion of the sky is a factor of 1,000 times larger than Gaia, the precision which Gaia is operating, and therefore it has to be taken out, it has to be modelled out in the data analysis as an absolutely first-order effect, not a subtle effect at all. And an important test of general relativity will arrive towards 2019 when the analysis is complete, because if general relativity doesn't give the right formulae for this deflection, if it's just off by parts in 1,000, it will be detectable. You know, that will show up in the Gaia data and one will know that something is wrong. Or alternatively, Einstein's theory will be vindicated to a new level of precision. Thank you.